You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this very special evening's event. My name is Erlyn Ebreck, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director of U.S. Programs. It is a thrill for us to host tonight's panel, featuring five RENIA fellows. During this panel discussion, the fellows will reflect on their fellowship experiences and speak on a range of topics that have open society implications. RENIA will moderate the discussion, and there will, of course, be time for Q&A. So we are clearly in for a rich and robust discussion. But before we start the session, I would like to say a few words about the genesis of the fellowship. The fellowship was developed to honor RENIA's human rights legacy by providing a two-year fellowship to talented young activists. The fellowship design offers fellows an opportunity to work alongside experts at the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, two of the organizations that RENIA helped develop and propel as powerful justice and human rights forces. The fellows projects are therefore aimed at strengthening respect for human rights in the United States. Tonight's panel, in fact, marks the launch and unveiling of this fellowship here at OSF. While the fellowship has been in existence since 2003, we have not previously had the honor of a presentation by the fellows of their work. So this is a moment to reflect on the impact of the fellowship and celebrate the work of the fellows. We are really very excited to have you all here and to hear about what you've been doing during the fellowship term. It was actually Gary LaMarche, the former executive director of U.S. programs, who proposed the creation of a fellowship to honor Ari's work in a very tangible way. The founding donors of the fellowship were George Soros and Herb and Marion Sandler, who created an endowment to support the fellowship. And they're obviously all very kind of close friends and associates of RIA. So we really owe a debt of thanks to all of them. And with that brief history, I want to finally take a moment to thank the OSF staff that have been critical to managing the fund, the endowment funds, and the grants that support the fellowships. And they are Meryl Sovner and George Shea, who've worked in the president's office and have been our internal point people on the fellowship. In addition, I want to say a huge thanks to OSF's controller, Sandra Sandifer, who wisely managed and invested the endowment account. And now with those words, I think I'm going to turn over to Laura Silber, who's the director of OSF's public affairs office, as she has a few words to say before we begin the panel. Laura.
Thanks, Erlyn. I'm just going to be a minute. I want to say Erlyn has talked about the creation of the fellowship and how great the fellows are, and we're really excited to have you here. We hope this is the first of many visits. And I just want to say a word about the future. We have some very exciting news, is that George Soros and the Open Society Foundations will make the fellows a permanent thing. And for as long as the Open Society Foundations remain in operation, which I hope is for a very long time, the RENIA fellows will exist. So we're very excited about that. And this is the first time, this is the first that RENIA is hearing about that. So we're very excited that you all could be with him when he hears this news. Thanks very much.
Thank you. That heightens the pleasure of this evening. I derive a number of other pleasures from it. I suppose one is that one ordinarily has to die before fellowship program gets named after you. And so it's very pleasant not to have undergone that particular experience, and nevertheless be able to have the fellowship program. The other special satisfaction that I take from the fellowship program is that during my own tenure at both the American Civil Liberties Union and at Human Rights Watch, I established fellowship programs at those organizations. I did so because it seemed to me that they would be important means of attracting very talented young people to careers in the civil liberties and human rights field, and that the field as a whole would benefit greatly from the establishment of such programs. That, in fact, has been the case. I have followed the careers of a number of those who were fellows at the ACLU and Human Rights Watch during my tenure at those organizations, which goes back quite a long way. And indeed, they are leading professionals in the field. To cite just one example, two of the persons who hold prominent positions here at the Open Society Foundations were fellows at Human Rights Watch, and that's how I first got to know them. Jim Goldston, who is the executive director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, was a fellow at Human Rights Watch. And Robert Cushion, who has played a leading role in our programs dealing with disabilities and our programs dealing with Roma in Eastern Europe, was also a fellow at Human Rights Watch. In fact, his wife, Dinah Pakempner, who's now the General Counsel of Human Rights Watch, was a fellow at the same time. We didn't know when we appointed them as fellows, in fact, that they were already a couple. But they both prevailed in the competition, and it was a rather substantial competition for those fellows. And I could cite a great many other examples of individuals who have taken on prominent roles in dealing with rights issues, who were graduates of those fellowship programs. So it seemed to me they fulfilled our purpose of greatly enriching the professional world of the defense of civil liberties and the protection of human rights. The way I'd like to do this this evening is, to the extent possible, I'd like to conduct a conversation among the five persons who have held fellowships. I should say that the program is actually at about its 10th year, or close to that. The five fellowships are two-year fellowships, in which the fellows spend 1 year each at the ACLU and 1 year at the Human Rights Watch. But in order to get things started in chronological order of their service as fellows, I'd like to ask each of them, and we've arranged them here on the in front of you in chronological order. I'd like to ask them to take no more than about 3 minutes to describe the project that they have focused on during their fellowship. So we would begin with Anjana Malhotra, who was the first of the fellows and is now the inaugural Fred Korematsu Clinical Teaching Fellow at Seattle University School of Law. And she also teaches in the law school's civil rights amicus and advocacy clinic. So, and Jana, would you start? And
sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. And first, I'd like to thank OSF and OSI and Arya Nair and George for putting this panel together. And it's as daunting to have been the first fellow to speak before the fellows that came after me because of the amazing work they did, capturing Arya's spirit and work through many years of fighting for people's rights and defending civil rights and human rights. So my project, my fellowship started 2 years after September 11th, when at a time when the U.S. government was engaging in overbroad policies targeting Muslims in the United States and abroad, and all Americans through improper practices. The U.S. government was sweeping through communities, arresting individuals arbitrarily, and engaging in racial profiling. John Ashcroft, soon after 9/11, said that instructed government officials to use their arsenal of tools, the full arsenal of tools, to arrest and to detain suspects under any provision they could. And fortunately, we had the wonderful arsenal of tools that Arya had developed over the years fighting for defending civil rights and human rights and civil liberties at our disposal, and the wonderful resources of Human Rights Watch and the ACLU that were already committed to this issue when I came on board. My focus was on the indefinite detention of individuals in the US as material witnesses. The government, after 9/11, arrested dozens of individuals without criminal charges, without the rights afforded to criminal suspects, and held them under a little used statute called the Material Witness Statute. This resulted in a campaign of indefinite detention of individuals without charges, which had a devastating impact on the folks that were arrested and all Americans, because it was a threat to our fundamental human rights and civil liberties. It was a very challenging policy to focus on because all of these arrests happened in secret. So the arsenal of tools that, and the meticulous research, the excellent legal work of the ACLU and Human Rights Watch were perfect for this task, as well as the folks working there. Jamie Fellner and Allison Parker at the US program, Ken Roth, who is the executive director at Human Rights Watch, Lee Gelernt, and Benson, we all put our heads together to come up with a plan on how to document, advocate around, and challenge these, this policy of indefinitely detaining primarily Muslims without any criminal charges, basically so the government could engage in fishing expeditions to figure out who was and was not a suspect. So we scoured court documents, court documents. We talked to community groups, Muslim groups throughout the country. We talked to individuals at mosques, looked at the 9/11 report, at congressional documents, try to figure out who these people were that were being held as witnesses in complete secrecy, and to document this issue. And by the end of the day, after crisscrossing the country and using the excellent meticulous legal standards and research methods at Human Rights Watch and the ACLU, we were able to document for the first time the number of witnesses detained under the statute and shine a light on, a very important light on this practice. Our findings, our research findings, showed that more than 70 individuals had been held without charges. More than half were not called to testify, even though they were witnesses. The government used baseless accusations to hold these individuals, and they misused this material witness law to circumvent the human rights and constitutional rights afforded to criminal suspects. The report we developed resulted in international media attention thanks to the excellent media and framing work of the folks at Human Rights Watch, Minky Warden, Carol Boger, and Emily Whitfield. We were able to get this on the front page of newspapers across the country, initiate congressional investigations, investigations by the OIG, to really shine a light on this and bring justice to these individuals whose lives had been really devastated by being held without charges. At the same time, at the ACLU, we used the legal arguments that we developed to help get witnesses out of jail that were being held without charges as witnesses. One prominent example was Brandon Mayfield, a white Muslim convert in Oregon who was held based on a, quote, 100% fingerprint match with a fingerprint found at the Madrid bombing site. He was arrested as a witness. The Spanish government said it wasn't the right match, and we eventually got him released, and the FBI apologized, and he eventually won a $2 million lawsuit against the government. And of course, we brought a case that ended up in the Supreme Court on behalf of Abdullah Al-Kid, an African-American U.S. citizen who was also a Muslim convert, that was arrested and held in detention for 15 days and strict conditions of supervised release for a year. We were successful in challenge. He was never called to testify. It really devastated his life. He wasn't able to pursue a PhD that he wanted to pursue abroad in the Middle East. And while at the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court had some problems holding John Ashcroft liable for his arrest and these patterns of the pattern of this misuse of the material witness. In a 5-4 decision, Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, said there were serious Fourth Amendment violations with the statute, which is an important legacy to prevent this prevent such misuse of the statute and unlawful arrests and detentions in the future. And so, and in addition, in that case, I just heard on remand the summary judgment arguments in Idaho on his behalf went really well, which is very important in creating tighter legal standards for individuals who could be subject to arrest as witnesses. And I believe we also won in the court of public opinion by shining a light on these severe and
That's
egregious.
An issue I want to come back to okay. in particular because the question one often encounters is if you pursue a case up to the U.S. Supreme Court and you don't prevail in the Supreme Court, can you nevertheless? Turn that into an advantage, or does it end up doing damage going forward? So I think that's a critical question that always faces us when we're dealing with civil liberties cases. So
absolutely, yes. So the end result was congressional inquiries, securing the release of material witnesses throughout the country. Writing a report that's now part of history that's being used in books written by authors who are publishing under Oxford University Press. The report's been cited in over 100 law review articles and cases because of the meticulous research done. And I normally would not say all this about my work, but this is the product of two institutions and tireless, excellent, rigorous advocates, as well as the tools that RA has developed and perfected for us.
I would disclaim credit for those things. There were an awful lot of people who were engaged in that process. But can we go on to you, Mee Lewis, who is now a senior staff attorney with the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU, and if you would talk about your work as a fellow.
Sure. So I was a fellow I'll speak up. I was a fellow between 2005 and 2007, and in that fellowship we were looking at conditions of confinement for girls in juvenile facilities. And the first part was to kind of look around and see where in the country this work might be useful, and after doing a kind of survey of states, I settled on New York. New York was a place where there was really very little known about conditions in those facilities. And one of the wonderful things about human rights documentation as a strategy is that that's what it does, is to produce new facts, new knowledge about an issue where there is absolutely zero awareness about what's going on. And the idea was that although there had been some work previously on juvenile conditions at Human Rights Watch and some litigation, that it tended to focus on boys. Boys are the majority of the kids in these institutions. And the intuition was that there were probably some very serious abuses occurring against girls, and that those abuses might take a slightly different dimension that could be well elucidated by human rights and especially children's rights standards. So I undertook that research, and we found a variety of abuses, particularly the excessive use of physical force, and physical force used as punishment, physical force used when it wasn't absolutely necessary, and therefore in a way that was out of compliance with international standards. And we found excessive security measures being used against the kids, which is common when you put children in a penal environment. A lot of the techniques and the physical environmental features tend to look like adult prisons, which is simply inappropriate when it comes to children. And we found insufficient services. Children who are incarcerated are entitled to services, but usually those are lacking, and we found that in this case. And very importantly, we found a lack of outside monitoring. So one kind of persistent feature of these institutions is that they are closed to the outside, and kids in particular have a very hard time maintaining family and community contacts and communicating with the outside world, even when abuses are occurring. So we found those things, and we described them in a report, and that's another wonderful advantage to human rights documentation, is that you really get the human voices. If you've looked at Human Rights Watch reports in the past, they are always very heavy on direct quotes from directly affected individuals. And those, I think those statements, you know, whenever I thumb through a Human Rights Watch report, that's really what stands out even more so than the application of human rights law, is the voices of the children or the other affected individuals. So we did advocacy around that, and there was, you know, some good that came out of that, but perhaps that will be a topic of the next question.
Okay, and you know, I don't remember if I told you this previously, but it was an issue I had gotten involved in 4 decades earlier. It would have been the latter half of the 1960s, when I was director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and I can still recall the circumstances of the case, because I had a call one day from a judge. Her name was Beatrice Burstein, and she was a judge on Long Island. And she told me that she had a regular practice of visiting detention facilities to which she had sentenced people. She wanted to see the circumstances in which those she had ordered confined were being held, and that she had gone to this one juvenile detention facility, and they couldn't produce one of the girls that she had sent there. And she was insistent, and eventually was led to the girl, who was being held in solitary confinement, had been held in solitary confinement for substantial period for what seemed to be rather minor infractions. And Judge Burstein called me at the Civil Liberties Union and asked that we do something on behalf of that young woman. And we did bring a lawsuit. It actually attracted a fair amount of attention. I think it's the only case that I can remember where it resulted in a novel. The New York Times reporter who covered the matter was a woman named Gertrude Samuels, long since gone. But Gertrude wrote a novel based on that particular case. And I think I still have a copy of her book in it. But the issues once dealt with, you know, don't remain solved. You have to keep coming back at them. And so I thought we had addressed that problem at that point in the 1960s. But a lot of things we addressed in that era are still with us. So, Alice Farmer, you are now today a researcher in the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, specializing in matters involving migrant children. So what was your fellowship about?
Sure. I was a fellow immediately following Mia, so from 2007 to 2009. And I think one of the advantages of the NIA fellowship is that it allows us to really bring international human rights standards into U.S. domestic issues. And the issue that we were working on during my fellowship was the use of corporal punishment in U.S. public schools. And this is something that quite clearly violates international law, but on which we had fairly direct Supreme Court precedent saying it was okay in the U.S. So we spent the first year of the fellowship documenting corporal punishment. It's used mostly in the south of the U.S. In public schools, it tends to be using a large wooden paddle, the kind you might see in fraternities, and that's used to hit the child, usually on their behind. And there's a quite large racial disparity in where where corporal punishment is applied. So African American students are being hit at quite higher rates than white students. And in the course of the first year, we put together a documentation report in Human Rights Watch's style. And we came to learn more and more about corporal punishment being used against students with disabilities. And so that became something we wanted to pursue in the second half of the fellowship. And we produced a second report specifically on the use of corporal punishment with students with disabilities. And there we were really finding problems. The punishment is something that violates children's rights in general. But with students with disabilities, we were finding that the impact of being hit, of this violent punishment, could in fact worsen their disability. So a student with autism, for instance, if this happened to them, it would increase some of their difficulties interacting socially that they were already having. Or another example from the work with disabilities was that sometimes students were in fact being punished for behaviors that were directly connected to the disability themselves. So I remember interviewing a family in Mississippi, and their child was a second grader who had Tourette's syndrome. And one of the tics that came from his Tourette's was to ball up his fists. And his teachers would perceive this as a violent tendency, and they would paddle him for it. So being able to work on that was a real privilege for me, a really interesting thing. And to be honest, it's the thing that got me into children's rights, and it's the thing that has me now followed into the Children's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch, which is the place I'm really happy to be.
I should point out that just as you were starting to speak, I saw that we were joined by Lois Whitman, who is the director of the Children's Rights Project of Human Rights Watch. And when one talks about someone directing a project, Lois created the project. It was her idea. She pushed for its establishment and made it a significant factor in the protection of human rights. And I especially want to pay tribute to Lois for the work that she has done, really pioneering work in the human rights field.
And so even though I cover a different issue now, Lois still lets me dabble occasionally in some corporal punishment work, which is great. We were never able to figure out how to bring litigation on corporal punishment issues, and it's still something I think we're interested in doing. And I know that the ACLU has recently taken up some disability rights work again, and so maybe this will be something we can move forward on. But we were able to have a small amount of impact in other areas. We had some federal hearings on corporal punishment. So the House subcommittee held a hearing, and we developed legislation with them. But in the current Congress, I don't have high hopes for that. But you know, we'll keep coming back to it, see what we can do. And in the course of my fellowship, working mainly with some wonderful state groups in Ohio and with the Ohio American Civil Liberties Union, we were able to get a ban on the use of corporal punishment there. And so, you know, it's something that we're gradually beginning to see some progress on. But to me, it's just, I'm so grateful to Arya Nair and to the Open Society for giving us the opportunity to learn how to do this stuff, because it's just one of the best jobs in the world to get to do this.
Thank you very much. Sarah Mehta is now a staff attorney at the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. My first assignment in working with the National ACLU was to work, starting in 1963, was to work with the ACLU of Michigan. So I'm very happy that you are now there. So what was your fellowship about?
Great. So my project, which was just officially ended in last fall, although I continue to work on it, was on people who have mental disabilities and what happens to them when they enter the U.S. immigration system. And we focused on two main aspects of that. First, the incredibly unfair hearings that people are subjected to in the U.S. immigration system. And second, the indefinite, often detention of people with mental disabilities while they're waiting for their proceedings to go forward. As maybe all of you already know in the audience, the projects were sort of developed by both of the organizations, and I often speculate that the reason my project came to the fore at my year were two reasons. One, that the advocates, meaning both the immigration lawyers and also mental health advocates, as well as criminal defense attorneys, had been so appalled for so many years about this problem of seeing people with very severe disabilities who are experiencing hallucinations on the stand, who had survived often very egregious torture in their homelands and came to the United States with brain trauma and now are expected to explain how they qualified for asylum or relief under Convention Against Torture, going through these proceedings knowing there was no way that they could possibly make a real claim. And at the same time, of course, we know that most people in the U.S. immigration system get critically unfair hearings. It's not exactly unique to people with mental disabilities, but I think nothing captures how absurd the system is, like seeing someone who is in one of these positions, like my client, one of my clients from last year, whose stutter was so severe that he was denied asylum because he was told he wasn't able to provide enough evidence or explain clearly his claim. Well, he couldn't explain his claim because his voice sounded like this, just knocking when he's trying to speak. So how could you possibly expect someone like this to be vindicating their rights in one of the most complicated legal systems in the United States? So for my report, we went to 12 different facilities spread across 9 different states in the United States, interviewing people mainly in immigration detention as well as family members and lawyers and other advocates outside about what they saw. And the two main focuses, as I said earlier, were first these deeply unfair hearings where people had no resources, no lawyers, no support system to be able to make these very complicated claims and literally fighting for their lives. I mean, going back to countries that many of them had not been to since they were babies, going to places where they had no support system, or like my client Mark Little, a U.S. citizen, going to a country that they were not from. And then on the other hand, when judges or even ICE in rare opportunities did make the effort to say, all right, something's not right here, we should slow down this process, we shouldn't just be processing people, but we should pause, that meant that those people were stuck in basically a legal black hole where they were subjected to indefinite detention with nothing to move their cases forward, waiting for some type of safeguards to be put in place, but with nothing to trigger them. So we issued our report in July, at sort of towards the end of my first fellowship year, and a week later we filed a class action lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit out of Southern California on behalf of all people with severe mental disabilities who had been detained for 6 months or longer, asking for them to get lawyers, asking for them to get release. That class was certified last fall, and we're in settlement talks at the moment. And we're actually very optimistic that we're going to see something very positive come out of that. In addition to that, there's been other work that even the federal government, somewhat in response to our advocacy, as along with the advocacy of a lot of other groups, have been developing, including potential pilot projects, other types of safeguards. There's some potential legislation that we drafted as well that would create, that would allow judges to terminate proceedings so that people weren't trapped in indefinite detention. And there's been an incredible amount of both media awareness about this issue as well as just education of our legislators. It's been really fascinating in any immigration detention hearing that's come up before the Senate in the past year to see at least one person asked about people with mental disabilities, that people are more aware of the fact that there is this whole subgroup of people that are expanding by the minute, frankly, given how many people are coming in from the criminal justice system that are going to predictably have these problems, and they're coming into a system that is still not set up for them. So that was the focus of our project.
Okay, thank you very much. And then the current fellow is Ian Kissel. I had the opportunity to get to know him before he held the fellowship, because Ian audited a course that I taught at Georgetown Law School. So he's stuck with me on two occasions so far. But Ian, what is your project?
So I'm currently in the first year of the fellowship, so working at Human Rights Watch, and my project focuses on the solitary confinement of youth held in adult jails and in adult prisons across the United States. From the beginning, the project's been a very close collaboration with the ACLU, as has often been the case from the very start with these projects. There's been a lot of interest about how the report can be used in many of the ways that the fellows have discussed in the past, and none of which I've yet to realize since I'm in the process, as we speak, of writing the report. So for my investigation, we knew that as a part of a focus on solitary confinement that the ACLU has undertaken, and Human Rights Watch has long worked on these issues, that we wanted to shift and focus specifically on the issue of youth in solitary confinement as one way to continue to sort of attack the broader issue of widespread solitary confinement in the United States. And so coming to the project, I spent much of the beginning of the fellowship reaching out to advocates, reaching out to affiliates, ACLU affiliates in particular states, and trying to get a sense of where there was less that was known about this problem, where documentation would make the largest contribution, and where there might be advocacy opportunities. And so what I've done is select five different states that I've traveled to. I've traveled to Colorado, to Michigan, to Florida, to Pennsylvania, and then done some work here in New York to interview youth. Primarily, I've spoken to youth in prison about their time in pretrial detention in jails, as well as in prisons. And of course, youth are charged as if they're adults in a variety of different mechanisms across the United States. So I've tried to have some balance among the different mechanisms and try to focus on states where there are a lot of youth, high numbers of youth charged as adults and held in adult jails and adult prisons. The types of solitary confinement, I think that there's really this broad spectrum that has many of the same features and causes many of the same harms to youth, and that includes prolonged protective solitary confinement to keep youth separate from adults. Sometimes that's mandated by law that they be held separate by adults from adults, or sometimes to protect them because they're particularly vulnerable. Sometimes they're classified as needing a higher amount of isolation to protect other inmates, usually through an application of a classification scheme that was designed for adults and doesn't take into account things like their lack of employment history because they're 15. And then, of course, disciplinary solitary confinement, for offenses that they, or infractions that are within the facility, as well as medical isolation for youth who are suicidal. And not surprisingly, as I described them, there are intersections of all of them, so youth who become suicidal when they're in punitive solitary confinement and the like. So that's been the documentation portion of the project, and I'll be launching a report at some point in the fall, and then we'll turn to advocacy and hope to, as I mentioned, implement a lot of the strategies with colleagues at both organizations. We're hoping to undertake some litigation to focus on perhaps the particular subclass of youth with mental disabilities who are held in solitary confinement, promoting legislative change in states where legislators might be open to chipping away at this systemic problem of youth being charged and treated as if they're adults and held in solitary confinement. And obviously a lot of media work to educate the public, because certainly when I came to this issue, I didn't realize the extent of it, and there are no good national numbers of how many youth are charged as adults or held in adult facilities, let alone subjected to solitary confinement. So we hope to make a contribution and also to shine a light on that as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Now all five of you are in your fellowships focused on American problems. Although the fellowships are divided between the ACLU, which focuses on the United States, and Human Rights Watch, which predominantly deals with international issues. Many years ago, I made the transition from the ACLU to Human Rights Watch, and a handful of others also made that transition. They had worked with the ACLU and moved into the international human rights field when that really developed, starting in the late 1970s. Alice referred in her comments to the effort to apply international human rights standards in the domestic American context in dealing with the problem of corporal punishment. And I wonder whether others also have found that their work includes an effort to apply international human rights standards in the United States, and whether that has been useful in dealing with American civil liberties problems, whether you've had difficulties, whether you've had a rejection of that. What's your experience in that? Have you been involved in that? Whoever wants to take that question.
I can start.
Go ahead.
So I think that's an aspect that's built into the NIAR Fellowship. The projects from their design phase are intended to use human rights norms in defining the problem, and then to the extent possible use human rights norms in responding to the problem. And so certainly we did that.
Also if you'd talk about human rights methodology, because I think that's quite different from the standard American civil liberties methodology. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the documentation as a method was something that was extremely helpful. And one of the, I think, criteria that we use when deciding whether something is amenable to a human rights approach is it something that very little is known about? Is it something that's going to benefit from this frame? And some other questions that we ask, in particular, are the domestic norms lacking? Is the domestic law, does it not kind of consider this as a problem that's actionable and so forth? And so we do use that in many ways.
I'm going to interrupt you again on that. In my experience in dealing with international human rights, documentation was effective in part because it was not all that difficult to arouse people about practices in other countries, such as torture or such as indefinite detention. On the other hand, if one tried to deal with something that had a somewhat analogous aspect within the United States in terms of documentation, and one deals with, let's say, the mentally disabled in confinement or something like, or mistreatment in the immigration process or something like that, it didn't arouse the same kinds of sympathies. And therefore, it wasn't necessarily an effective means of trying to ameliorate a situation. In some respects, it was easier to elicit public sympathy for something that was done by that nasty government overseas than something that might be done, let's say, by the benign government of New York State. And I wonder if that entered into the question of whether you, was that your experience, in fact, and did that enter into the question of whether you rely on documentation as a significant means of trying to promote rights?
I think in the case of my project, it was really a kind of pragmatic consideration that there just wasn't information available about this particular situation, and so documentation was kind of the logical approach to it. And, you know, I think in other situations, it is possible even to get a backlash when you talk about human rights, partly because, you know, some American judges, some others are hostile to the idea of imposing what they view as a foreign legal regime on U.S. courts. But in when we were talking about children who are in confinement, I think it was a very positive thing to use a human rights frame. There had been people who were trying to address some of these issues previously, but talking about it without human rights, the benefits of that frame. And so, for example, where excessive force was concerned, the discussion was about youth or juveniles being subjected to a certain face-down restraint procedure, which nobody seemed to find compelling at all. And then when Human Rights Watch came in, and Human Rights Watch being known for producing reports about atrocities abroad, and you know, came out with a report that said these places that are somewhere around Albany and Ithaca are torturing children, and use the terminology children rather than youth or juveniles, and use the terminology of excessive force and violation of human rights rather than the more kind of technical or institutional jargon, that really helped to kind of break open the issue and to get some change.
And I mean, I agree with Mia that sometimes in the U.S. context, we do get some backlash on using words like UN, referring to UN conventions or international standards. Certainly, when I was in Mississippi, that wasn't going to get me very far. But I think the challenge of documentation is to find, like, our job is to figure out how to tell that story well, right? So there really shouldn't be that many problems that wouldn't be suited to documentation because we think the victim is unsympathetic. It's our job to figure out how to make it sympathetic. And I think the US program at Human Rights Watch has done some amazing work on documenting things that are inherently unsympathetic, but finding the way to tell that story quite powerfully.
The principal modus operandi of the ACLU over the years has been to secure redress for the individual victim of civil liberties abuse, to try to use the courts, but also to try to use administrative structures of the state in order to try to secure redress. By and large, the ACLU has not relied on documentation as a tool for protecting rights in the United States. There have been times when it did so, but it's not been a predominant method. And you know, in my experience, the reliance on seeking redress was, on the one hand, based on the view that the courts in particular would be a forum in which it would be possible to secure that kind of redress. Secondly, that it wasn't always the case that one could win public sympathy if one documented various kinds of abuses. If you document abuses involving, let's say, the incredibly high level of incarceration in the United States, there's a large body of public opinion which feels, well, that's appropriate. They should be in prison. It doesn't necessarily advance the cause of dealing with the problem of incarceration. On the other hand, in the international human rights field, it's only under relatively unusual circumstances that one can secure legal redress. There are international judicial systems, the European Court of Human Rights, the European Court of Justice, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Most of the time, first of all, there are large portions of the world, all of Asia, all of the Middle East, where there is no legal redress available internationally. There is, theoretically, there is a form of legal redress in Africa. It is barely functional at this stage in terms of actually providing protection. And documentation is, in fact, the effective way to try to protect human rights internationally. In my day, shifting from the ACLU to Human Rights Watch, there was a cultural divide between the two institutions. The means of trying to protect rights were so different that there was hardly any crossover in the actual work that was done, and there was relatively little communication between the two. You're right that a purpose of the fellowships has been to try to lower the barriers between the two approaches, but I'm wondering how much those barriers still exist.
I mean, just on the documentation point, I think there are two things. First of all, given the hostility of the United States Supreme Court to anything that looks like civil rights, frankly, right now, I think more people will be relying on non-litigation type tools like documentation. But I also think it seems strange to me to have a dichotomy between litigation and documentation when, as someone who does public interest impact litigation, where you're looking at systemic reform, there's no way to do that without documentation. I mean, every day I spend 3 hours at a homeless shelter in the morning and then 3 hours going door to door, meeting with clients at night, outside, you know, and then doing that every weekend, building cases, building stories, building the narrative. And part of it's because sometimes I know I'm not going to be able to litigate that case because of whatever legal hurdles come up or because of things that happen independently with our clients. And so we need to find other ways to tell that story in other convincing ways. And sometimes it's because you really can't win a case or build a case if you don't have those facts. I mean, to me, there's been no better training for my current job as a litigator than working at Human Rights Watch and learning those tools and learning how to build a case and how to get all the additional secondary source material that you need, how to fill in all of the different gaps, how to work with experts, how to think about also what remedy you want, what that should look like, and what the people you're representing and working with want it to look like. So to me, I mean, I think my project just worked out so beautifully, really, where I had constant contact, really, with both organizations. And of course, in the beginning, it was also because I knew absolutely nothing about immigration law. And so I went to the ACLU every week asking for some type of briefing. But, you know, for us, I think the projects that were designed to be something that complemented both organizations, that both had identified as being a priority, and that both would be able to use that fit into their own priorities and their own advocacy as things that they thought they'd be able to do. And one of the things that I think all of us have done in our fellowships is to come up with sort of a range of products. I mean, litigation is only one product, and it's only one tool that you use as a public interest advocate. You know, the other things that we've done have been, you know, obviously legislation, have been working with community groups and doing public education, I've been working with the press. So to me, I think the project just, it doesn't seem at all odd that those two institutions would be working together on something like this. And I think it's a really fantastic opportunity, and it's something that if only you had the opportunity to do that with every single one of your cases, to get the skills and resources and support from both, from two big institutions that are helping you build a story like that.
And I'll just add to that that documentation is so critical for building and analyzing patterns of abuse, which has a really good fit for the work necessary in developing class action suits to systemically challenge litigation. And I feel like that Human Rights Watch has had a lot to offer the ACLU in how to identify those patterns in very intense, meticulous detail, how to systematize problems. And I think also that documentation and that methodology provides the ability to create a very public and thorough record that a complaint in litigation can never do, a record that can spur reform, that gives credibility to the research findings, to the issues that we're trying to tackle. And especially when the courts are the way they are, that record, when we released the report in on material witnesses, there was an immediate invitation to the Senate Judiciary Committee to testify on these abuses because of our report, which was fantastic. And in our in the material witness context, we worked with the ACLU International Human Rights Project to bring to vindicate individuals' rights in international tribunals, in the UN, in the UN Commission for Human Rights. There was a finding of a violation of the ICCPR, which on behalf of, I think, maybe 10 or 12 people who were wrongly held as witnesses, which was going to be difficult to do in U.S. courts at the time, because at the time, judges were still a bit reluctant to challenge the national security allegations and concerns of the U.S. government. The international tribunals provided that really critical first, hard-hitting critique of what the U.S. government was doing to Muslims in this country that created not just an important victory of the world, kind of looking at the U.S., of the U.S. reflecting on itself, but also for the individuals whose rights were vindicated through those tribunals.
Do you want to get out of this?
I just wanted to say one thing on the discussion of the collaboration between the two organizations, that perhaps one of the experiences that I've had in my travels and then in beginning the documentation portion of it has been also to highlight issues for the ACLU lawyers on the ground, for other litigators who have very finite resources, and to be able to, I mean, that's a sort of further benefit of the collaboration of the kind of documentation, is to really bring an issue to the fore for a partner who might pursue those other kinds of strategies that a Human Rights Watch might not be able to. So I think that it's worked, at least for me, incredibly well between the two organizations in that respect.
Let me ask an entirely different question. Four of the five fellows are women, and I'll tell you my history in this field. When I directed the New York Civil Liberties Union in the second half of the 1960s, virtually all of the professionals I brought onto the staff were men. When I directed the National ACLU in the 1970s, things sort of evened out. When I moved to Human Rights Watch in the 1980s, the balance shifted so that at that point it got to be close to the percentages here this evening. It turned out to be about 80% or close to that in women who were the professionals, the researchers, the advocates on the staff. In your experience among your colleagues, is it true today that it is predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly women who are becoming the professionals in the civil liberties and human rights field?
I mean, I think one of the challenges in human rights and civil liberties is that we perhaps, I mean, we live in a world where it seems to be getting increasingly expensive to, you know, raise children and buy houses, and we're paid okay, but not as well as some other fields. And I think maybe that's one of the things that means that men are less likely to be in the field.
That was certainly true, I found, in the 1980s. That is, there were women of talent and skill who were available to work for Human Rights Watch in the period. And the disproportion in the hiring reflected the talent pool that was available. There were more able women who were willing to work for what in those days were the very poor salaries at Human Rights Watch. I'm not sure they're that much better today, but certainly they were dreadful at that period. But we were nevertheless still able to get some extraordinarily able and talented people to work for the organization. And as I say, predominantly women.
My observation at the ACLU is that it's fairly well integrated in terms of the gender balance. Human rights as a field, I've always felt, I mean, in the years that I was in it, was dominated by women. And my feeling is that there's a split among, there's the foreign policy world, which seems to be fairly male-dominated. Perhaps I'm not that well aware of it, but the kind of diplomacy that people who are interested in international affairs, but from a kind of, I don't know, you know, national advantage type of standpoint, that tends to be men who enter that field, and then the human rights is the kind of alternative that women seem to enter, and I'm not sure exactly why that is, but it seems to be how it pans out.
Okay. All right, I'm simply curious as to you know, whether this, I mean, the shift in my own history was very substantial, very discernible at that style. I can remember at the New York Civil Liberties Union, we had, I think, six or seven attorneys on the staff, and they were all male at that period. And there was never again a period in my history in this field where anything like that could have been the case.
It may be that the constituency is different now. At the beginning, Human Rights Watch was mainly concerned with male political dissidents. That's my impression. I don't know if that's correct. And now it seems like with the Women's Rights Division and with, you know, perhaps there are the kind of scope of what is considered to be a human rights concern has involved more issues that, you know, involve women or that women feel, you know, interested in.
All right, let me open this up to those who want to ask questions. And if you want to ask a question, if you would go to the microphone so that everybody can hear you.
Hi, my name is Alan Kritzler, and I basically, my past is in government oversight. And one concern I have, and I was very interested to hear the about the report about rather indefinite detention as an issue. And I'm very concerned about what's happened with the National Defense Authorization Act and indefinite detention and the potential for, given the way it's written, such a blurring of definitions that today you may be saying suspicion of terrorist and associated groups, but that over time that might wander to suspicion of dissidents. And I'm a little concerned about some of the things that happened in the Chicago demonstrations against NATO, including the accusation of terrorism infractions. So that I'm interested in hearing anything anyone wants to say about the danger of the drift of detentions towards dissidents in this kind of society. Thanks.
Sure.
Janet, do you want to?
Sure. Well, one positive recent development is that a district court judge in the Southern District of New York recently enjoined the indefinite detention provisions of the NDAA. And one really exciting thing about that litigation is that the coalition of amicus that supported the challenge were Republican lawmakers, the American Conservative Liberties Union, the 10th Amendment Center, as well as progressive organizations. So, and the suit was on behalf of prominent journalists who have interviewed Guantanamo detainees. So I see that as a really positive development in both the challenge and public opinion of such indefinite detention rules. I think they're, you know, an anathema to our constitutional system that's well recognized by a broad range of folks. But I think it's important to stay, you know, continuously vigilant. We don't know how that litigation is going to proceed. But the U.S. has always been. What was so interesting about doing my research is that the U.S. government championed the arbitrary detention provisions in the U.N. Charter and in international human rights treatises. And we've always stood by the requirement of probable cause to assure that and criminal procedural protection to assure that the right against arbitrary detention was protected. And I think it's going to be equally important to stay vigilant about that because, you know, when weighing national security and government authority to authority and power in protecting national security against individual liberty interests, public opinion and even courts will always kind of tend to sway towards the government's interest and national security. But over, you know, in the years after September 11th, a broader consensus has developed, and I was really excited to see this with our report that, you know, it was Republican legislators in the Senate Judiciary Committee and Congress that wanted to reform the material witness law to make sure this didn't happen again. Because I think it speaks to some indefinite detention without charges. Under the material witness law, it didn't happen again because it's you know, those basic protections, 48 hours before you see a judge, criminal charges issued, probable cause, the safeguard, you know, the Speedy Trial Act, the Sixth Amendment, these are all such critical safeguards that that I think with time a broader swath of the population are interested in protecting, and that fight is. That fight is critical and ongoing. So,
Okay, what, can I just ask one follow-up? Is there anything in the material witness statute that prevents it being used in things other than terrorism issues so that it might drift over again to crimes that involve freedom of speech, et cetera?
The statute's very broad. It allows the arrest of witnesses who have any material information to a crime and who are likely to flee. So, and then there's a deposition provision. So theoretically it does. It's what happens in practice that where that gets abused and what happens with the courts. You know, how the court judges were signing off on these warrants without kind of looking closely at the details of the government's allegations. So, so I think that the report had the effect of making judges more aware and the public more aware of how that statute should be properly used. You know, it was intended for the mafia witness who's going to likely to flee because he doesn't want to testify. That danger is always there, and every year, every 2 years, the office, the Department of Justice OIG does a check on the number of detentions under that statute to, you know, make sure that it's not getting out of hand, but it's a primarily complaint-driven process. So I think the continued vigilance is really important.
Good. Thank you.
Hi, I think my question is maybe for Mia. My name is Pamela Whalen. Growing up in Manhattan in the 1960s, I was in grammar school in the Village, in Greenwich Village, and my friends and I after school would walk kind of veering towards 10th Street near Greenwich Avenue, 6th Avenue, and there'd be, I think the building's still there today, a red brick women's house of detention.
It was torn down. It's now a little park next to the library there, and property values in the immediate vicinity have gone up because the prison was torn down.
Was it there a long time? Because I remember women screaming out from the top.
I was one of those who had a contrarian view on that. I actually thought it should stay there, in part because a critical problem for those in detention is having visitors, family visitors, lawyers to visit, and so forth, and located over there at 10th Street, it was extremely easy for people to visit. If you have to go to Rikers Island, it gets to be much more complicated to visit. But a lot of people, and I could understand this, I lived then and now a few blocks away, and you would have people standing outside yelling to the women inside, and the women would be yelling back to the people on the street, and that was an ongoing form of communication between the detainees and, you know, family and friends.
Do you know what year about it was torn down? Recently?
It must have been it must have been in the 1970s. I don't remember exactly when it happened, but it's a very nice little park right now.
Thank you.
Women's House of Detention.
Hi, I'm Allison Parker, the director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, and it's been my intense pleasure to work with each of these young activists during their time at Human Rights Watch, and of course also collaborate as their careers have progressed in each and every case in very exciting directions. I wanted to ask, we've explored obviously the tools that Human Rights Watch has and the tools that the ACLU provides. And they might be summarized in terms of human rights documentation and methodology versus litigation and in impact strategies and use of the US courts. But I suppose because I have had this privilege of working with each of you so closely, I wanted to ask a much more practical question. And that is if you could just reflect on, in the course of your work, those moments when you chose to wear your Human Rights Watch hat and the moments when you chose to wear your ACLU hat, And just give us a sense of why you made those choices and how your association with either or both of the organizations either helped or perhaps hindered you as you progressed in your work. Thank you.
I'll take that on.
I'll give a general response. That's a great question, Allison. You know, I was thinking in terms of in interacting with government officials on this issue when I wanted to be more diplomatic and kind of massage an answer out of someone, I would use my Human Rights Watch hat a lot because they are so savvy and are not always in a contrary litigation position and so well received for both their foreign policy work and their human rights work by government officials. So I remember interviewing the former U.S. attorney of the Southern District of New York on counterterrorism practices, and it was very effective to wear my Human Rights Watch hat over my ACLU hat, because I think the ACLU would represent this totally everyone would be afraid of being sued, so that's one aspect. And then in talking with community groups, I found it very effective to use my Human Rights Watch hat because people like the language of human rights, it speaks to them. I was dealing with a lot of immigrants from throughout the world, and they understood that language and what we were trying to do. So that's a short answer. Yeah, but it was both came in very, very helpful.
I would mention that it sort of depends where you are, right? Because in Mississippi, I would say neither was helpful. Just huge resistance from both. But I think particularly, I think you're right to say that the language of human rights can really resonate. And so particularly working with teenagers, when I can explain to them why we want to talk to them and why their voice matters and how I'll use what they say in a report, just by even being able to do that, that's something that I find a lot of the people that I talk to, they find that engaging and they want to work with me. And it's often their kids who people don't really listen to otherwise. And so in that setting, I really like in the present day my Human Rights Watch hat there.
I mean, I guess, you know, similarly to what Anji said, it was, you know, especially when I started the project and we needed to get into the facilities. And then again, after we sued ICE as the ACLU, it was very helpful to be able to say that I was also with Human Rights Watch. I don't think they bought it, frankly, most of the time. I have to say, I was so angry with ICE by the time we finished my report, just furious about individual things that had happened to our clients, that as much as I loved doing documentation, I really wanted to sue them. I just couldn't wait to file that lawsuit. I was so upset about the way that they repeatedly treated our clients and treated me also in some of the meetings I'd had with them and their dismissiveness about it, that I was really proud to say that I was with the ACLU when we filed that lawsuit and that I was standing up with all these other ACLU attorneys that had been filing, you know, sort of smaller actions, habeas actions for these clients and had been building this case. I mean, they were very proud to say that I worked with Human Rights Watch. It was very convenient, especially when we did this first round of settlement talks, to be able to say, well, we have this human rights expert who's been doing this documentation and you don't have anybody like that who's been documenting this issue. So I think they enjoyed having someone who looked a little bit more objective while being actively in the litigation. But I really enjoyed both roles. I think, you know, right now I certainly kept with the ACLU at this point because of that type of energy that I feel that is directed towards using the court system.
No, I think because the ACLU goes into court in the United States, it has a much more confrontational aura than Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch, working globally and relying very heavily on documentation, doesn't have that confrontational quality. And so I think it's fairly natural that there would be very often a greater receptivity to Human Rights Watch than there would be to the ACLU. But you know, in some other countries where there are human rights organizations and civil liberties organizations, There is also that difference, and the civil liberties organizations have often played a sort of crucial role in limiting the abuses that take place. Right now in Hungary, there is a populist government that has been very abusive with respect to rights, and has sought constitutional amendments which significantly diminish the power of independent courts, and it has been particularly difficult so far as the Roma minority is concerned in Hungary. And the Hungarian Civil Liberties Union, which models itself on the ACLU, is the confrontational organization in the country, but it has really been the foremost organization standing in the way of abuses that are taking place. There aren't civil liberties organizations in most of the European countries. But there is an immensely effective civil liberties organization in the United Kingdom. It's not as old as the ACLU, but it's not that much younger. It was founded in 1934. The ACLU was started in 1920. And what was called the National Council of Civil Liberties, today it's called Liberty, has been the foremost organization restricting or limiting the ability of successive governments in the UK under Tony Blair and under Gordon Brown from putting into place quite severe restrictions on civil liberties dealing with the threat of terrorism. So there's on the one hand, you can very often achieve more through diplomatic efforts with the human rights label. But sometimes there is also the need for the more confrontational style of the civil liberties organizations, which rush to court to try to obstruct violations of civil liberties.
My name's Don Cipriani. I'm with the Just and Fair Schools Fund at Public Interest Projects. My question is related and maybe linked to the discussion before about the gender balance and who's doing the work in the field. When I saw the information about tonight's event, the two things struck me right away. First was the stunning work that's been achieved through the fellowships. And second, that three of the five of you have work that's perhaps most directly linked to children's rights. And I'm wondering, does that mean over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to see the majority of people doing human rights specializing in children's rights?
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons that this project, that the NIA fellowship structure lends itself well to children's rights, is that the international human rights law on children is so strong that the Children's Rights Convention is signed by every country in the world except for us and Somalia. And so we can make some quite credible arguments about the U.S. being bound by portions of children's rights law, even though they haven't signed on to that convention. And so I honestly don't know if that helped play into the selection of these projects, but it is a sort of natural reason why, if we think about using human rights in the U.S., the body of law that exists for children's rights is one of the more powerful ones out there.
And I would add to that another body of international law, which is developing rapidly, also applies to some of the work that you have been doing. The United Nations adopted the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities in 2003. And it went into effect in 2006 because of the number of ratifications that have taken place. I think at the moment There are more than 100 countries that have ratified the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. It has not been ratified by the United States. I gather that it's going to come up relatively soon in the Congress, but the concern that disabilities rights advocates have is that if the United States adopts the convention, it will be done with various reservations and understandings, as has been the case with a number of international human rights treaties, and effectively those reservations and understandings will greatly diminish the impact of the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. The argument for not ratifying it has been that there is disability law in the United States that protects the disabled, but in fact the convention is far stronger than the disability law that does exist. And the U.S. Supreme Court has been diminishing the effectiveness of the disability law that we do have. So this area of disability rights is another area where the international standards and the international protection are becoming or have become significantly better than the protections in the United States. There has been a myth that rights are legally protected in the United States better than in other countries. And there are areas where that is true. I would say it is mainly true in the free speech area or matters related to First Amendment rights in the United States, where the protections are really stronger than any place else. But when one comes to other aspects of law, like the protection of children or the protection of the disabled, international law has raced far ahead of the United States in terms of the protection of rights. Last question.
Hi, my name is Jaspreet Singh. I'm the co-founder of the International Center for Advocates Against Discrimination. I'm from Georgia, and I've been hit with one of those paddles, and they've really hurt. And two, I'm equally frustrated with ICE and the immigration system. I've dealt with a lot of issues with them. It's very difficult to work in a system where, you know, you're asking someone who's been tortured or who has faced something so difficult to express, and then, you know, ask that person to testify and be convincing. It's sometimes too difficult. I wanted to ask a general question about setting bad Supreme Court precedent. You mentioned that earlier, Mr. Nair. You know, with the kind of work that we do with civil liberties, and it's sometimes you face situations where a case is very unpopular, and you do have to make that difficult decision of, say, not proceeding or trying to figure out a way around the situation. And we've seen bad Supreme Court precedent in the past get overturned, but that road is a very difficult one. So that was a question I wanted to bring back up to the panelists. How is it that you, I mean, I know we could say it's on a case-by-case basis, but generally, how do you deal with that issue?
Let me take that on. There are cases that one loses in court and where one wins in practice. And there are cases where one wins in court and one loses in practice. And it gets to be quite important to try to figure out when things are going to go one way or things are going to go the other way. I'll give you an example of a case that was lost in the U.S. Supreme Court a very important case, and nevertheless, it was one in practice. In 1972, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Laird versus Tatum, and the case involved political surveillance by the United States military. That is, the military was engaged in domestic political surveillance in the United States. It grew out of the urban riots of the 1960s, in which the National Guard would be called up to deal with the urban riots. And then the military got it into its head that it should have its own surveillance data in order to cope with these riots. But what they did was to infiltrate anti-war organizations and things of that sort. And there were more than 1,000 military personnel who were engaged full-time in domestic political surveillance in the United States. And it came to light, it started during the Johnson administration. It came to light during the Nixon administration. And the Nixon administration very strongly defended, upheld the military political surveillance. The spokesperson for the Nixon administration was William Rehnquist, who was then an assistant attorney general, and who also testified before congressional committees upholding the political surveillance. Despite that, he participated in the U.S. Supreme Court 5-4 decision upholding political surveillance, and that became a big issue as to whether he should have recused himself. But the Supreme Court upheld the surveillance 5-4, but the case aroused outrage. In fact, it turned out to be a key factor in dismantling what had been a very extensive political surveillance system that had grown up in the United States. And subsequent lower court decisions bent over backwards to differentiate the facts in those cases from the facts in Laird versus Tatum. And the federal courts ended up playing a leading role in the late 1970s and the early 1980s in dismantling political surveillance systems. And here in New York City, the Red Squad of the police had files on 1 million persons. In Chicago, the Red Squad had files on 400,000 persons. It was like that all over the United States. And that was dismantled during that period in the wake of a losing US Supreme Court decision. So the political surveillance issue couldn't stand the public exposure. The public exposure, even in a losing case, did it in. Now, take a different result. Take the problem today of stop and frisk in New York. It's everybody is talking about stop and frisk. In New York. The way that happened, stop and frisk happened, is the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Mapp versus Ohio in 1961, which said illegally seized evidence could not be admitted in state court criminal proceedings. And in the wake of Mapp versus Ohio, law enforcement struggled for ways to overcome the decision. The initial response was what were called dropsy cases. Dropsy cases in the New York criminal courts were cases in which police would testify, as I approached the defendant, I saw him becoming apprehensive, and I saw him reach into his pocket and drop something to the ground. And on examination, it was a cellophane packet containing marijuana. And so there was no illegal search. The police officer had seen the marijuana fall to the ground. the police perjured themselves, but it was a way around Mapp versus Ohio. And then a bright district attorney here in New York State named Richard Q got the idea of legislation which is the stop and frisk legislation. It was adopted by the New York State Legislature in 1965. It was upheld by the US Supreme Court in 1968. We have 700,000 or so cases of stop and frisk in New York today. And this is the long-term legacy of the police effort or the law enforcement effort to get around the US Supreme Court decision in Mapp versus Ohio. The rule I came up with for myself on these kinds of things was that one was most vulnerable to having a victory turn into a loss when there could be low level or low visibility decisions by public officials that resulted in violations of rights. That is, a free speech matter could never be could never result in turning a victory into a loss, because that doesn't involve those kinds of low-level bureaucratic decisions. When you do have low visibility bureaucratic decision making, the bureaucrats can very often, and the bureaucrats I include the police or I include other officials, can through their own initiative defeat what has been achieved through a Supreme Court decision. And so one has to, if one is going to be effective in protecting rights, not only rely on the victory in court, but one has to devise a plan, and it's not so easy to do this, as to how to actually implement a crucial decision. It's one of the really difficult issues in the whole field of protection of rights. Anyway, I'm sorry. I meant to have the fellows do most of the talking, and I'm sorry to sort of do this myself. But I think we've run out of time, so I'm not going to extend this further. And I'm very grateful to the five fellows. I'm very grateful for the establishment of the fellowship program. I think this program is, it's a wonderful thing, and it's especially a wonderful thing for me to have my name attached to it. So thank you very much.
If I could for just a moment continue that spirit of gratitude and just take a moment on behalf of all of the fellows. We'd like to present Arye, you with two tokens of our appreciation and of congratulation in the event of your retirement. One is a set of those reports that we produced in your name.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
The other is two images, one a Human Rights Watch production and the other an ACLU production.
Okay. Thank you very much.